All right. Let's go ahead and get started here. Seems like Brandon is here to rescue us because it is absolutely cooking in here. I'm normally cooking when it's 60 something in here. It's almost 80. I'm already sweating. It's going to be a problem, but we'll have to just get through it here. As we get started here, I do want to say just a couple quick things. First of all, thanks to Seth for doing a little bit of a marathon there. He taught 6 classes in a row. We were out for a good portion of that, Nikki and I, taking really the first extended vacation I've taken in almost 7 years. For our 25th, we went on a bit of a trip. I didn't listen, of course, but I was able to look back over Seth's lesson, and looks like he did a great job incorporating what we had done before back in 2013 when we taught this class and adding some good stuff to it. So I'm sure that was really some good classes there. And secondly, I will add to that, I'm having an incredibly hard time getting back into not being on vacation mode. I go back to work tomorrow for the first time, and I don't think I'm going to stay all day. I don't think I could put in a full day. So I may be a little bit light on material today, just kind of put it off and decided this morning that my vacation wasn't over, so Scott Gary was kind enough to let me go shoot some at his farm and scope in one of my rifles, and kind of forgot about the recoil a little bit and smacked myself in the nose with the scope. So tomorrow I'm sure I'm going to have black eyes. That's what I get for not doing my Bible lesson but going shooting instead, right? God told me what I should have been doing. Man, it is really cooking in here. Ugh. Okay. So where are we at? Obviously, we are in this section, the last section of the class that we split up, what we called, quote-unquote, modern history here. So we have this 7 lessons on the Reformation through today, and Seth has been good enough to take those first 3 there, talking about the Reformation itself, and then the move to the New World with the Puritans and those things, how they came here from England. And so we are in class number 27, the first period here of this restoration movement. So today we're going to cover that gap between the Reformation and the Restoration. We'll cover some of that, leave a little bit for on Sunday. And then Seth is going to take the 2 classes again, 29 and 30 there, about the modern doctrines and the things that have popped up here probably in the last 50 to 60 years or so, and what we face today a little bit. And then that class 31, that will be 2 weeks from today, Wednesday, the January 2nd. This class runs into January this time. So the last day of this class will be the 6th of January. So January 2nd, that local history, Paul Cook has agreed to give us a lesson on this local congregation, where it came from, how it started, how we got to where we are today. He did that for us back in 2013 also, and I learned a lot, so I really hope you're looking forward to that. It's really he does a great job with that, as he does with everything there. So just kind of a quick review here. We talked about the Reformation, that it happened there between 1517 and 1648 or so. Kind of really started with Martin Luther publishing his 95 Theses, and then ended in 1968 with the Treaties of Peaceful Westphalia, which really were the end of those 2 wars there, and kind of the final result of the Reformation. What was the Reformation? It was 131 years of both religious and political upheaval, because you may remember that before that, the church and the state were very much what? Yeah, they were tied together, right? Okay. The church had its hand in politics, and no local, even some of the kings and the rulers of the countries only had their ability as the church let them, and the church would excommunicate people it didn't like and do those kind of things. So it really had, the church played a huge role in secular and political realm. It did start as religious reforms. Many groups were rebelling against the Roman Catholic Church, and rebelling, I shouldn't say they necessarily were rebelling against the church itself, we'll talk about that, but it did happen across Europe, and it turned into those 2 wars, as of course it couldn't start out with just being purely religious, because church and state were so tied together that as certain kingdoms and certain kings, especially those who had been excommunicated or had been put out by the church, were now trying to say, well, wait a minute, you don't have that right. They were trying to take back lands that had been assumed by the church. So it really turned into those two wars, the 30 Years' War and the 80 Years' War there. Some key people in the Reformers that Seth did a good job talking about, John Wycliffe and Jan Hus were two guys who really kind of put it out there before. They were squashed very quickly by the Roman Catholic Church. And then, of course, the two guys that just due to time, that we only had time to really cover, probably the most important two of the Reformation movement, Martin Luther and John Calvin. Then there's a list of some others that you hopefully should at least know about or have heard of, and if you haven't, you kind of need to look at those. I did want to cover just a few in somewhat of a review, somewhat of just some things that I wanted to point out specifically, since I didn't get to touch that. I wanted to talk about some points to remember about the Reformation. And the first and foremost thing that I think is important for us to understand is that the Reformation did not meet the goals of the Reformers. It didn't accomplish at all what they wanted to happen, okay? Really and truly, what did most of the Reformers want? Well, they actually didn't even want to go back to the beginning. They just wanted to go back to a previous version of what? Of the Catholic Church. That's right, okay? Most of them, I put this up there, most of them absolutely loved what they saw as the one true church, and many of them were trained as priests. In fact, almost all of them were trained as priests, trained as lawyers through church law, which is kind of a funky thing to say. But so they really and truly loved the church. They just were unhappy with certain practices and certain policies. Okay, and I'm not going to bring all those up there, but what were some of the big ones that they were really against? Indulgences is the one that kind of broke the camel's back, right? Okay. Most of the Reformers really got in their mind that things needed to change when they went where? Almost all of them, their efforts to change the church happened when they went to Rome, to the church headquarters. Because what did they find there? Yeah, opulence and power and riches and all these things that they saw in the Bible, the church wasn't supposed to be, right? And they saw these indulgences being sold in order to, you know, finance not only church buildings and things like that, but individual church leaders, right, would want to build their own palaces and their own houses. So that's when the Catholic Church started that, you know, if you sold an indulgence, you got to keep 15% of what that indulgence was for yourself. And so really, some people went crazy with that. And so all of those reformations started when they went to headquarters. But again, they weren't necessarily trying to say we need to get rid of the Catholic Church. They were just saying that we want it to go back. And they definitely didn't want to see it split. They did not want to see the church split. They wanted it to remain whole. They just wanted to get some of these kind of changes. They really wanted true reformation, not some kind of new beginning or a new church to start. And of course, many of them would be appalled with what has been done based on their teachings, right? If you were to tell Martin Luther that there was going to be millions of people who called themselves Lutherans, he would have had a conniption, okay? He did not want that to happen. Now, it shouldn't surprise us when we read in 1 Corinthians, Paul is writing there to the Corinthians, and already what were they doing? Yeah, the same thing, right? I'm of Cephas, I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos. They were already starting to identify themselves by the names of men. So it shouldn't surprise us, and I think that any of these reformers who, you know, would see what happened later probably wouldn't be shocked by that, but it's definitely not something that they wanted to happen. Martin Luther absolutely did not go around saying, you should follow me instead of the church. He didn't do that. But yeah, that's what people did. Just like Apollos didn't go around saying, you should be Apollosites. Right? He just didn't do that. But yet people are people, and they did that. Which is kind of my next point here. So what happened? Well, people is what happened. Right? People always find a way to mess things up. It's just the nature of people. You have some who are doing good, some who are doing bad. some who make things worse on purpose, some who just accidentally find themselves, you know, they don't understand how they got to where they got, but yet that's where they ended up. So what really happened there is that when the Reformation did not actually reform the Catholic Church in the vision of the people who were the reformers, and then even more so the people who were reading those writings, right? So Martin Luther wrote these things, and Wycliffe and Huss and those kind of people wrote all these things. There were people who read them and who became influenced, and they also agreed that these changes should happen. But unlike those guys who were saying, I'm going to stay part of the church, I just want it to change, these people said, well, I want those changes too. And when those changes didn't happen, what did they do? They decided we need to split and we need to leave. Okay? And so that's really what happened. And unfortunately, this idea of Protestant or that we're changing different from the Catholic Church, really that's the idea of Protestant, right? As I left the Catholic Church there, once it started, it didn't stop. Because once you get in your mindset that the real answer, if you're not happy with what's going on at church, quote unquote, that I better leave, what's always going to be the case? Yeah, there's always going to be people who are unhappy with the way things are, and what are they going to do? They're going to leave, okay? In fact, we see from some of these that there are groups that were, multiple groups that were started by the same person, because he was unhappy where he was at, so he went somewhere else and started that work, and then, of course, people, other people besides him, came into that work and changed it from what he wanted, so what did he do? Left that one and started another one, okay? Which, by the way, does that still happen today? Absolutely it does. Nikki and I just were visiting in Texas, and we heard about, you know, one group that is having some problems, and it really seems to be based around some individuals, and now they're starting a new work, and sometimes I'm just baffled by what happens when people don't focus on this idea of unity here and what that happens. So as a result of the Reformation, what really happens is Christianity fractures. And instead of being really divided into two primary groups, which were what? Even before Protestant. There was the Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodoxy, right? Or the Eastern Catholic Church, okay? And that made up 99.9% of people who would have called themselves Christians, were those two groups. Now all of a sudden we're going to see Christianity fracture over the next several hundred years. So this is a chart that basically shows, and I know you can't read it, hold on a second, from all the way back here, I'm supposed to have a light here, so all the way back on the left is the beginning. You'll notice for the first 1,500 years, there were some minor changes, but primarily what happened? Little groups went off, but they died out. And primarily you had one main branch of Christianity for 1,500 years. Then all of a sudden you get to 1,500, what happens? It explodes, right? Okay, so we start to see there, I'm just going to zoom in on that section here. So really starting about 1517, when Martin Luther publishes that, is whenever things start to just go crazy. And we start to have all these splits, and this group splits from that group, and you know, even in this chart, this is just an extremely basic representation. It does not include everything. And it doesn't show all of the influences, too. Like you may see up there Churches of Christ, which we would identify with. This chart shows them branching primarily off of the American Episcopal movement with Methodist and Pentecostal, which is true, but they were equally started from Baptist and other groups too, right? Presbyterian. So this is just very simplistic. But it does a good job of showing the idea here that in that time period of right around what we would call that Reformation, you went from one or two branches to about 30. Because once this idea of we can split started to become predominant in people's mind, that's always there, right? I've always said, and don't get mad at me, that one of the great things about Bowling Green is that there are so many congregations in town. But one of the worst things about Bowling Green is that there's so many congregations in town. Because if people aren't happy, what do you see happen? They just shuffle around and we can move to this other group. Rather than trying to work together to resolve our distances and really try to better the church, we just want to avoid that and we're just going to split. Okay? And it really bothers me. But this mindset of if it's okay to split has never left Christianity as a whole. That mindset just has not left since the Reformation. Okay, it's still there today. It's getting worse, actually, I think. So let's talk then just briefly about this path to restoration. And we'll talk in a minute about the restoration movement and what it is. But as America was continuing to be settled, we start to see changes really happening, okay? And groups continue to separate from the Catholic Church and the Church of England on a regular basis. So I'm just going to throw up some dates here of some of the major groups that as they started to split off here from the mid-1500s all the way up to the mid-1700s. And this is just a list of the major groups. And you'll see those names over to the right. That doesn't necessarily mean, again, that those guys were the ones who wanted that movement to start, but that movement started based on their teaching, right? Okay. So again, in 1530, the Lutheran Church, it didn't really start with Martin Luther, but that's when Martin Luther started teaching, and so that's kind of where they would trace their roots. Does that make sense? Not necessarily that Martin Luther started a whole separate church, but just that was based on his teachings there. So there continues to be this split here then. So what's the difference between this idea of the Reformation versus the Restoration? Well, it's not a lot, but yet very profound, right? Okay. They both have the same goal, which is what? We want to make the church what? Better. We want to make the church more like what it's supposed to be. Now, whose idea of what it's supposed to be we can talk about, and that's why there's all these separate groups. But it's all the same basic idea. Looking at the church as it is today, there's problems that I see. I don't like that. I don't think that's right. We need to make changes. The difference is, how are they going to do that? So the idea of reforming really is the idea of staying but going back. Okay? Now, what point, we can argue all day, what point in time do I want to reform to? You know, Martin Luther really wanted to reform to pre-Dark Ages period. He didn't want to go back all the way to New Testament times. You know, he felt that the rite of the Catholic Church and that a lot of those, the same things of, you know, not just doctrine, but also, you know, your traditions and the teachings of the rulers was important, you know? So he wanted to stay, but just go back to a certain point in time. Reformation tends to be about slow changes, okay? We know where we want to get to, but because I want to stay part of the group, what do you have to do? You have to first convince people that there needs to be a change, because what's true about 90% of people all the time? That they just don't want to change. Even if they think it's wrong, they're happy to just stay where they're at because that's easier than trying to change, right? So first of all, you have to convince people that we need to change, and then you need to work on it over time. So this idea of reformation is just, here's the problems, let's work together on them, and as long as we're working toward that goal, we're pretty much happy with it. As opposed to the idea of restoration, or to restore, usually means that we either have to leave or we're just going to say, you know what, starting today, we're going to do things differently. Okay? It's much more of the fast path. There's a lot of impatience for changes there. I'm not saying that's wrong. Usually we think of impatience as a bad thing. But I see something wrong, and guess what? I'm not okay with that. It needs to change right now. Not, it's okay if it happens over the next couple hundred years. It needs to change right now. And usually this idea to restore means that you have little or no ties with the current situation. you're perfectly okay with walking away from everything that's there in order to try to fix the problem rather than saying, well, we still have to hold on to this, right? It's really restart, okay, is the idea of the restoration there. And then I put this up one of the first classes, and then Seth, I believe, used this too, this chart I put together quite a while ago, about the idea that either when you realize that the church has gone through an apostasy to the point where there needs to be a change, you have to take one of these two paths. And Jim brought up, no matter which path it is, the idea of repentance, right? That we're changing from the way we are to go back to what God wants us to do. It really just is, how do I want to get there? They both have the same goal, but hugely fundamentally different in the tactics that we want to take and how we're going to try to accomplish that. Does that make sense? The difference there? Okay. So, we talked about, and Seth did a good job talking about that there were a lot of reasons for the restoration. And I don't want to rehash those. But if we talk about here, what are the reasons or the specific causes of the Reformation movement, I think that there are some similarities to the Reformation movement, but also some differences there. So the resurgence and the circulation of the Bible is huge. Of course, with the printing press and that first go-around for the Reformation, the Bible became, for the first time, readily available, right? So one of the things that I like to talk about is that previously to that printing press, it became the idea that, you know, to purchase a Bible for the common person was like a year's worth of wages, is how much an actual Bible would cost, because they were hand-copied and so laborious, right? But even after the printing press, the price of the Bible dropped dramatically, but it still really wasn't to the point where every single person had their own copy. There were a lot more copies available, and you could get a hold of one, but they really weren't just available for everybody. And that's kind of the way things stayed for a long time, until, primarily in the U.S., is where we see this huge resurgence in the idea of the circulation of the Bible. There's also a huge growth and interest in American English translations, as, of course, we are trying to identify ourselves as a new nation, relatively new anyway, trying to break away from English rule. Just like many of these restore people, we're trying to break away from the Church of England and some of those Protestants. Religions, there was just this huge idea that we need a more modern version. And so with that, there became this huge publishing thing, and it goes from, instead of being a year's worth of wages, it was about 2 weeks' worth of wages for your average person to buy a Bible, to when you start hitting that 1750 or so, it becomes about a half a day's worth of wages is what a Bible costs. Now, of course, in today's world, it's an hour or less, right? You can pick up a Bible for you can get it for free anywhere, just about. But unless you're buying some, you know, leather-bound, calf-skin version, you know, Bibles are very, very expensive. Inexpensive. They're very available to everybody. That's just the way it was, okay? The way it is now. It's not always the way it was. So as part of that, the cost drops dramatically. So while books were becoming very much more affordable, still, your average person didn't have a library. If you walk into my house today, between Nikki and I, we've probably got close to 1,000 books that we've bought over our lifetime. That's unprecedented previous to this century. Okay? So if you're a family living at home and you know you want to have books and you're religious and so you want to go buy books, but yet still, food is kind of important, right? And you got to have a house. So you're going to have a limited library. For the first time, the idea becomes around that it's more important to own a Bible instead of owning the book the church wants to give you. Okay? That's a radical idea. Because previous to this, what would, quote unquote, the church have said? You don't need to read the whole Bible. Here is this smaller book that we have distilled down what the Bible teaches so you can read it and you can understand it. Even some of the early Protestant churches did the exact same thing. Even though they railed against that in the Catholic Church, they did the exact same thing. Here's the things you should believe. But people started to reject against that. And so they were buying Bibles instead of church doctrine books. Another big change is rural churches, for the first time, become the majority. They are still not the majority in number of people. Just like today, there's more rural cities, but yet still, where is the population? In the big cities. Same thing with the church, okay? There, for the first time, really started to become a lot of local rural churches. Previously to this, the churches existed primarily in the cities. In fact, as you were spreading across this country, you got to be named an actual city instead of a town when you got what? A church building. It was one of the requirements. For you to reach that town, that city level, you had to have a church. Okay? So now all of a sudden, these local rural churches are the majority of the number of congregations. But of course, they're still much smaller, which means poorer. Okay, they don't have fancy buildings. They don't have huge libraries. Okay, and there becomes less and less interest from national leadership. What is true today when we have any kind of political campaign? You know, how many times has whoever's running for president come to Bowling Green, Kentucky? Never. Because, well, maybe sometime, I don't know. Never since I've been here, how about that? Because on the big picture, how big is Bowling Green, Kentucky? Little. I guarantee you no one running for president has ever been to Round Hill, Kentucky. Right? Because why? There's just not enough people there. You go to where the votes are. And if you're a church leader and you're focused on my hierarchy and the structure and how are we going to run this church, where do you focus? Where the people are. Okay? So these rural churches are not getting a lot of attention from these national organizations. So they start to feel the pressure to change. There's a strong feeling that the Reformation was carried too far in the idea that when they start to look at the fruits of the Reformation, they don't look at it as a good change in the church. It just starts to be viewed as, why do we have so many different churches? Okay? It's just division for the sake of division. Where is this idea of unity? Okay? And of course, even within those groups that have started, splinter groups are starting to form, causing even more division and more question. People are just getting fed up with it. So that's one of the things behind this restoration movement. The Reformation groups started looking more like Catholicism. Pretty soon, the very thing that they railed against and wanted to change, what did they start to look like? Almost the exact same thing, that's right. They continued to ordain clergy and to follow a lot of ritualism, which were some of the big things that the Reformation was against. They started to amass land and actual dollar wealth as these national organizations started to become bigger and more people started funneling money into them. And they continued to emphasize the idea of creed over scripture. These were the very things that the Reformation was founded against, but yet these groups were starting to look more and more like that. Again, why? People are people, right? It's just it's power, authority, money, right? It influences, and it becomes a problem there, okay? Interestingly enough, along with the idea of Bibles becoming available, really the ability to publish material on your own becomes much more widely available. So yes, Bibles and books and things that were published by these big publishing houses were becoming down and reducing costs. But yet, if I'm a little local person and I want to publish something, it was incredibly difficult for me to break into that market, right? But now, all of a sudden, you start getting around that, you know, late 1700s, early 1800s, there starts to become, you know, the movable type printing presses that are much smaller and people can buy one in your home and, you know, I mean, it's really expensive still, but you could get a hold of one and you could, all of a sudden, yourself make several thousand copies of something if you wanted to distribute it, okay? That's going to really radically change the method in which the message is going to get out here, okay? So they start to have access and the ability to start sending out. And we start to see for the first time these kind of terms coming into church literature. Newsletters, tracts, the papers, or people are actually now copying down as someone's preaching. They're transcribing what they're preaching and then publishing that. Okay, that's really the first time that this has ever happened. So how was the Restoration Movement different from the Reformation Movement? Most importantly, it happened locally. Many groups came to the same conclusions separately, often not even meeting, and we'll talk more about that in just a minute here. For the first time, it starts both with people who are educated in the church and also people who are not. Because more and more people are reading the Bible for themselves and they're just saying, what I see here does not seem to fit what I see when I go to service, or does not seem to fit what I see in my church. So you don't have to have this great education in order to be able to understand that. Okay? There is no interest in reform. They felt that was unsuccessful before. If I work from within and we try to say, you know what, I see these changes, but I still like this group, I still want to be identified with that group, it just doesn't seem to work. So the mindset is we need to try something different here. Because it is too easy to go back or to continue to incorporate undesirable elements. Martin Luther published his 75 theses, right? If he could have got 65 of them done, do you think he would have been happy? What? 95. That's right. If he could have got 75 of those, that's what I was trying to say. If he could have got 75 of those 95 done, do you think he would have been happy? He'd have been thrilled that he could get that much done. And so those other 20 all of a sudden wouldn't have become that important, even though he still thought they were wrong, right? So this idea of we're going to compromise and only be okay with the little changes, that really is not something that people were interested in more anymore. And of course, there's no single group that people are trying to leave. Okay, so now there's going to be the early Restoration leaders come from all different denominations, Baptist, Methodist, Lutheran, and Presbyterian. Very few come from within Catholicism itself, but yet there's not one group that we're trying to leave. So they don't have all these things in common. I did want to cover briefly some of the principles of the Restoration Movement and what they felt were the primary reasons that there was this need to restore the church here. So for those principles of restoration, first and foremost, Jesus is the one and only head of the church. In all of the Reformation groups, that was not true. In all of them, they still relied on a man or a group of men, or what they would call councils or synods or those kind of things in order to make those decisions. Okay? So one of the primary principles of the Restoration Movement is that no man or no council can make changes that Christ didn't approve. He is the one and only true head of the church. And based on that, then, the New Testament is the only rule of faith and practice. We must discard all creeds, statements of faith, articles that are written, separate books, all that kind of stuff has got to be discarded. And we just need to go back to purely the New Testament. It's critical. They all felt that local congregational autonomy was important. We have no ruling bodies or groups to decide for other congregations what's going to happen. The New Testament contains the only structure needed. The only terms that we see there are elders, deacons, and evangelists. Any other titles, especially that of reverend or father, were particularly offensive to this group of people, they should all be discarded. A core belief is that there should be unity among believers. This is kind of hard to say, and then what do you do? Split. But they believe strongly in the unity of believers. We must stop the division and fighting, and Christ Church must be unified, but there was a lot of question of how do we get there? It's not okay. This is where we see later in the Restoration Movement a further split of the Restoration Movement between those who feel that correct is most important versus those that feel unity is more important. And sometimes, of course, because it's people, right? Ideally, those two should not be in anything that has a problem coexisting. But when you start to introduce people into that, you're going to have a problem there, okay? The gospel message is libertarian in nature, okay? This is a big change from things that happened before. You must have liberty of conscience. In the New Testament, we see that your conscience is more important than what someone says. It is not restrictive in nature. The idea of freedom from slavery is true freedom. Christianity is primarily individual in nature. Your personal relationship with Christ is the key, and your personal relationship with Christ is more important than any membership that you would have in any group or any church. How is that a big difference from not only before the Reformation, but of the Reformation? Individuals didn't matter in those movements, right? It was all about the group and the church and conforming, okay? So those are some big changes that were going to take place there. How are we doing on time? I didn't bring my phone today. Oh, 3 minutes? Oh, I thought I'd be done early. Huh. 8 minutes? Okay. Well, we'll get done when we get done. I got to sit down, though. I'm cooking up here. Okay. I want to talk about a couple of early leaders of the Restoration Movement just to kind of introduce us to this idea. We're going to talk about two groups of them, and then we'll save the rest for next time. So some of the earliest people that we would consider as part of this Restoration Movement were a couple of people named James O'Kelly and Rice Haggard. They both lived, they were born a little bit earlier and lived a little bit later, but their primary working years were from 1775 to 1825. They were both from a Methodist congregation in Virginia. They saw a lot of the problems in the Methodist Church, especially at the time. The Methodist Church was still very much so tied to the Church of England, and so they really wanted the Methodist Church to split from the Church of England, to become its own group, and to enact some of these changes. So when that Methodist Church would not do that, they decided to go their own way, and they started a group called the Republican Methodists. Okay? They started a congregation there in the late 1700s, early 1790s, and then in 1794, they had a big meeting about the congregation that changed it, and very famously, Rice Haggard stood up in the middle of that meeting and said this. Brethren, holding up a Bible, he said, "Brethren, this is sufficient rule of faith and practice. By it we are told that the disciples were called Christians, and I move that henceforth and forever the followers of Christ be known as Christian simply, as opposed to all these other names that were out there." Okay? That day, that meeting in 1974, that group made two decisions that they formally enacted, that the Bible would be their only creed. They quit using the Methodist doctrine and books, and that they would change their name to only be called Christians. It still took several years for them to achieve actual status as a church and to do that. And so in 1801, we see these two guys started the Christian Church, officially began. And interestingly enough, I almost don't know how you do this, but for everything that they went against having a creed, they did write down the five principles of the Christian Church. Those five principles were: the Lord Jesus is the only head of the church. The name Christian, we will use the name Christian to the exclusion of all other names. The Old Testament and the New Testament are only creed. Christian character is the only test of church membership and fellowship. And the right of private judgment and liberty of conscience would rule over church rule. Okay? Pretty interesting statements. And they continued their work until, and that church kind of stayed as it was, spread a little bit. They published some different kinds of documents and some newsletters that got read, but really didn't pick up a lot of movement, and both of those guys ended up passing. almost the exact same time in different parts of the country, these two guys, Elias Smith and Abner Jones, their primary work was about a 10 to 15 year shift later than O'Kelly and Haggard. So they were both from Baptist background, not from Methodist like the first two. They grew up separately in New Hampshire and Vermont respectively. And primarily when they looked at the Baptist church, they had problems with the teaching of Calvinism, specifically predestination and a limited number of those who would be saved. So they left the Baptist church separately, completely separately. They left the Baptist church and started writing tracts about the Bible and producing these in volume. This is the first time, I think, I don't know this for sure because I'm not a super historian, but this is what we would call the beginning of our tract rack. Very simple, one page folded that they could hand out themselves. Okay, they started writing these about the beliefs in the Bible. And even though they were separate in two different states, they wrote almost identical ideology. They did not meet until 1803. So in 1805, these two guys start Christ's church. The fundamental beliefs were that there was no head over the church but Christ, so we named it Christ's church. New Testament only, they did not believe that the Old Testament had anything about current doctrine. It was a good book to read, but it didn't have anything to do with current doctrine. And of course, no religious name but Christian. Notice that even though these were happening in three different states originally from two different congregation or Reformation groups, a lot of the beliefs that they were publishing were the exact same. In fact, it's interestingly to note that despite all their similarities, these two never met O'Kelly and Haggard. They never had any kind of collusion or anything like that, but yet they were producing almost the exact same material and were working toward the same goal. These are what we would call the early reformers. So next time, on Sunday, we are going to cover these three groups, which I'm sure you have heard of some of them at least. Barton Stone, from right here in Kentucky. John Raccoon Smith, who started in Tennessee. And Thomas and Alexander Campbell, who actually were from Ireland, but came over and had some huge influence in this restoration movement. So if you want to read ahead a little bit on something, if you want to look up these three names, that's what we're going to cover on Sunday. All right. I got to be close, right? It's got to be almost time. Usually that bell cuts me off. So I'll give you a minute.